circle back on and go more in depth on a particular thing. I'd like to hear that as well. Over the next week or two, we have this natural break built in right here, but I would need to know it in these next two sessions tonight or by sometime next week. And if not, I'll just go with the current plan. Those last three classes are special topics anyways. This is a concluding wrap-up class of this side of the curriculum anyway. So does that make sense? But I'd be happy to have your special topics. Make me just as happy. Do you ever have a chance to write those down for the 23rd and 30th? So that was our review. So did you find the reading interesting? No? Nobody?
Yes.
One person. Okay. I guess one's not bad.
Yeah.
Is it close enough? Is that people for this time? So that's a that takes place under what circumstances? So they would call it just two sentences. Okay. So the Chaldean Empire is in its ascendancy. At this point, the Assyrians, who they're displacing, have already carried away the northern tribes of Israel. And what's left of the kingdom of Judah is suffered from internal decay and the kingdom.
Okay.
And it's generally not a good situation. This is how the book of Habakkuk opens it. If you're in fact God, why is this happening? And is that not essentially what we mean by when we use the phrase, it's a common phrase by the way, we didn't invent that tonight, this idea of the problem of evil. It's the oldest and most effective argument that atheism has. It hands down is. Why? Why is it that quick?
logical. After this, practical, and it's undeniable. Nobody says evil doesn't exist, really, or that it doesn't have practical implications for it, or that it does seem to present some logical challenges, right, to what we're going to talk about. So, this is fun. Is there anybody here that would you describe God this way? All three? Two of the three? All three with a qualifier? Anything?
Okay.
Any qualifiers? So what is the traditional argument then? What's the basic form of the argument?
Half of God that's all powerful and all knowing and all seeing and all there happened of the evil.
Thank you. Did anybody not know that? Did anybody not heard that before? You've heard some form of that 1,000 times, right?
I didn't hear you again.
Can you say it louder?
If we have a God that's all-knowing and all-powerful and all-good, then...
And intends to be good.
Intends to be good. Then how can we be evil? Why would he allow evil to happen?
It's a fascinating question, I think. Has anyone heard this example before? The American philosopher William Ruff. Uses the example of the pond, and he talks about a more sophisticated problem of what's commonly called in this when you can read articles and such on this topic, the even more difficult problem of natural evil. In other words, just things happening in the world, not even caused by like a serial killer or something like that, which is problematic enough, I think. But in his particular example, that's pretty well understood. You can think it doesn't have to be a pawn. I'm not sure why I picked a pawn, but it's effective especially if you're a fan of Bambi. Why unjustifiable natural evil? A forest fire traps a fawn. It's horribly burned and it lies in excruciating agony for days before death finally releases it. How is that logically consistent with an all-powerful, all-knowing, and benevolent God? Even for those of us who will make the argument that some degree of suffering and evil is a critical component to human development, how does that scenario support any human spiritual development? How does that have any relationship to a human soul in heaven? Anything like that? Who can explain that? And who can reconcile that? Unjustifiable natural evil with an omniscient, omnipotent, and benevolent God. God created the world and set certain things in order that would naturally happen.
So God made evil.
No.
I'm sorry, then I misunderstood. Go ahead.
I don't know.
I'm just asking a question.
I don't know. Is it?
A lot of people would say that it is.
Well, that wasn't how it was.
That's a great point. Can we save the class last 40 minutes? Can we save that one to the end? So,
what did you say? That's not what it was in the
garden. Don't skip to the end. Go through the process.
But you can see how some would see that this is an objection, right? I like to eat here, so I'm not like particularly attached, but I can take the same thing and you have to be ready to confront this with people. You have to be ready to discuss this with people because it comes up, and like we said in the beginning, it is real and tangible. It is a practical problem that is confronted by humans everywhere. Humans, you know, everywhere. Because forget William Rowe and the deer. I can make it more real for you. What good or what God would allow babies to starve, to have mothers that use drugs? What God would allow, this is the earthquake in Haiti. This is the Holocaust in Poland. Everybody agrees that we are being for the idea of an omniscient, an omnipotent, and benevolent God. And this is, in fact, the logical premise that the atheistic argument is based upon. We will acknowledge going in this premise, okay, if in fact, because this is an argument that attempts to be based on logical inconsistency. So if in fact you have a God that's capable of anything, knows everything, and you claim wants to do nothing but good, then certainly, really almost a trivial aspect or subset of that would be the prevention of suffering, wouldn't it? Isn't that sort of included in the definition of benevolent? Premise number two, which is actually line three here, is that yet no one in the debate denies the practical reality of suffering or evil or whatever word you want to put in there. The conclusion there being, the conclusion of this argument being founded on the offered proof of logical inconsistency is that no such God is the one claimed in the first premise of this. Has anyone not encountered this argument? The most common one. And what do you typically say to it? We're so predictable here. So, what do you say? Go ahead.
Well, I always try to use the example of, okay, if you're a parent, you love your children, and you can protect your children, why do you ever let anything happen to them? You can prevent it, and yet you do. Why? I mean, there's within my power to just about eliminate all physical risk for my children. But to do so means I snuff out essentially their existence. And so my point to that is, what's the purpose of God? And that, when I always see this, my first point is, you have misunderstood the purpose of God. The purpose of God wasn't to prevent anything from happening to his children, any more than my purpose is to prevent everything from happening to my children. My purpose is to try to prepare them for what's going to happen so that they can handle it in an appropriate way. And it's always been my opinion that they miss the whole point of their argument. They go straight to, if you had the power to stop everything, you would, when in fact their own lives prove they have the power to stop a great many things and don't.
Let's seize, somebody can even write it down. Seize upon just sort of the assertion that Eric just made, that perhaps something in this discussion up to this point fundamentally either misunderstands or misrepresents the purpose of God. somebody else, something different.
One of the arguments that I have used is free will. God has given us the ability to make decisions and choices based on our own feelings, our thoughts,
okay.
And acting on those feelings or thoughts will result. If it's not aligned with God's will, then sin. And so sin by definition is a transgression from God's will. So in the world we live in, everyone has options and choices to act on whatever they choose to do. And if it's not in accordance with God's will, you'll have a lot of effects, like suffering, pain, a lot of bad things, right? And that doesn't just affect you, it affects others, it affects your family, and it could actually go on and on and on, affecting generations. You know, like, think about a mother who maybe is promiscuous, or a father who is promiscuous and brings a disease into his, like HIV or something, into his home, right? He gets his wife, his wife gets pregnant, has a kid, and that disease continues for another generation. So suffering and pain, I remember talking to a friend who's in entrepreneur, who believes that money could solve all the problems, and all the entrepreneurs, if they would get together, they would solve all the problems in this world. And I totally know that's not true, because as long as you have people with a lot of money, you will have a lot of people who will exploit others, who will steal, who will, and so you will always have those who will have a negative impact of those who will do those kinds of things. So that's kind of like some of the arguments that I have.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. But now, let's write down free will. All right, somebody else, something good? Yes. Capture that one as divine justice?
Yeah.
Okay. Somebody else, something different. Oh, don't make me wrong, because I just said you guys were all going to be predictable. You haven't hit the one on me. How do you know what's good? Going back to basic philosophy here. You're not, you won't, none of you will buy into this, but it's an argument that's common. How do you know what's good? Okay. Does it stand in opposition to anything? Is good and evil somehow defined by one another? Is there a sense in which evil is a necessary condition of you want to have this thing called good?
Evil defines
good. I agree with you. I'm trying to introduce something that is common in this discussion, though, to others. That there's an argument that's made on the basis of necessary conditions. That the two, for purposes of definition, you need to have both. Otherwise, if there was nothing evil, how would you know what good was? What would you compare that to? How would you know? A lot of this stuff gets wrapped into one of these arguments that are built upon this.
the free will one is definitely a biblical concept and is true. It's not the answer I go to. And I think in all of these discussions, this is the area where it surprises me how much time people spend outside of the Bible discussing this. Because I think the Bible actually addresses this question rather exhaustively. I have some thoughts on why we're not that good at it. A couple of you hit on this. You copied this a little bit. Eric. Sorry. Yeah, so C.S. Lewis agreed with, he hit on this idea of free will, but also, you know, what would be the purpose out of it? I'll just read it the way he expressed it. Trying to show the logical inconsistency of a conceived of condition such as the one proposed by the atheist.
Yes, sir.
Is it possible that he's also touching on the very point of Job, which is, okay, you know, God answered a little bit differently, makes the point a little bit differently, which is, you know, where were you when I was created the world? Where were you? But the logical question is, if we talk about, we go straight to the benevolent. I always wonder why we don't focus on the omniscient and the omnipotent, which is, okay, if you could create the universe, how would you create it? And you know, when you start to try to think through the mind of God, your head explodes and you come back to it.
That's okay. And I could have listed a couple of, on the previous slide, right, free will and necessary condition. Those are the ones that you would commonly see just in, like, they're a broad appeal in our society. Among our own brotherhood, we often make the argument based on what Eric just said, and we call it the argument from limited knowledge. I mean, human limited knowledge, obviously. But we frequently make the argument of limited knowledge. And it's based on primarily, and this gets to my point, an admonition if it applies, that there's a reason why I think we're often not that good at this particular topic area, and that is that I have an opinion about four books in particular in the Bible that happen to address the problem of evil more thoroughly than other books of the Bible. One of the four being the Book of Job, which argues the question of limited human knowledge and understanding and insight, in parallel, supernatural or divine purpose that we don't perceive. Does anybody want to guess what the other books are? Well, yeah, that's the other one. Whoever caught on. It was in the Moyer reading. It was addressed in the Moyer reading, and it's the slide we led with. So on a societal level, Habakkuk's dealing with, on a societal level, the problem of evil. Two more. I didn't include those because those were just cherry picking, very, very limited, narrow examples.
I would say Revelation.
Thank you. The Revelation. And I'm thinking of Psalms, which discusses the role of evil more on where Habakkuk is focusing on societal implications. Psalms, in many cases, not all of them, several. Are discussing the implications for the individual. The Revelation is probably the most comprehensive discussion of the topic, explaining God's divine purpose in all of it. Why we don't begin all of our discussions in those four pieces of text on this topic, I'll never understand, because they speak directly to the very heart of the matter, in my opinion, and they all circle back on these things. It's been my experience. I don't know. This is speaking of generalities here, but those unfortunately happen to be, and I'm sort of comparing. You know, have you had? I'll ask it this way:
Have you been in more Bible classes on the book of Matthew or on Habakkuk? But no, you're supposed to not just laugh. So you've had, and so have you had more Bible classes on Acts or Psalms? Of course, Acts. Come on, I go to the same church you do. I know. Yeah. So, but those happen to be four books that we're not particularly, as a group, if I had to characterize it, those are not our strong suits. Yeah. And so I think that is part, I simply mentioned that for what it's worth. That might explain some of our stumbling in this area. It's my opinion. But here's some other verses that I want to just put up here, have you read them, and let's discuss them. And they go to this topic. What do you think of when you read this in terms of, what is this telling you about tonight's topic?
What in the eyes of man may appear to be suffering or evil? God may be using for a good.
It looks to me like God intentionally made him blind so that God could be glorified in a way that people could understand.
Yeah.
Yes. Or does the natural disaster allow us the opportunity to respond to the suffering of our fellow man? I mean, isn't that when the best, we always talk about the best in people comes out? Is when the worst that we see happens to them, to somebody else. I mean, that's where love is truly manifested.
This is again, now Eric's back to the necessary condition argument, but it's not without a lot of merit. Does the Bible command any of you to be compassionate?
Yeah.
What's a necessary condition of compassion?
People who are suffering.
Some unfortunate circumstance? Would you ever be able to be obedient to the command to be compassionate without it? I'm gonna just build on your comment. Does God have the ability to eliminate? I'm gonna pick something. And I just lost my train of thought. Sickness.
Yes.
Did God sometimes do that?
Yes.
Did he do it for everybody?
No.
Did what?
Did it for me.
Did Jesus ever address this directly, that question? What about poverty? Could God wipe out poverty, although the word itself, I realize, lacks objectivity. It's a relative measure. But does God have the ability to eliminate poverty, however you define it? Did Jesus sometimes do that? Did he do it all the time for everyone? Did he ever address that directly? What did he say? Why? How is that benevolent?
So we could cover.
Oh.
Did you want us to say?
It is. It's more important, and I think it goes to. It goes deeper than that. I don't. I say something that often brings me. I make a. Some people think I make this point far too strongly, and argue the principle into an absolute, which I do. I admit to it, just a lot of people don't agree. That in Matthew, on the Day of Judgment, Jesus makes it clear that he divides people into two groups, the saved and the unsaved, the sheep and the goats, and things like that, and he And obviously we recognize that there's more criteria that are used, but there he discusses some criteria. And they include things like caring for the poor, the sick, those in prison, things like that. And it's presented in this positivistic sense, in that not that you chose not to, but that you failed to. You failed to. These things, these circumstances are a necessary condition of salvation and spiritual development. They actually are. This is an argument that's made almost uniquely within our own brotherhood, but I think they're the most biblical arguments to be made. You will have the poor with you always, because without them, none of us go to heaven. Because none of us can begin to comply with the commandments that God has set down before us. None of us would be able to do this, all these things that the Bible says are so very necessary for spiritual development and maturity. They certainly often serve a purpose that limited human knowledge keeps us from understanding. Somebody said earlier, what matters is not the things that actually happen in this life, but how we respond. Somebody used the word respond. So on the individual level here, it's important that we not necessarily understand the why, the wherefore, whatever, but that we do what we need to learn to do, I think, and Habakkuk and Revelation teach this, is you won't necessarily, and these things, the hand of God moving the affairs of men will outlast our own lifespan. And so we can never even hope to see or glimpse the whole thing. And what's not important is that, I don't think it is important that we perceive the root cause of it or the purpose of a particular thing, but that we do recognize the hand of God and that we seek His will for our own choices and our own response in those things.
God chastens those He loves.
Yes. Using the example from Hebrews, the example that Eric used earlier of the human parent with the human child, even. This is a rather basic principle. And I'm going to go back at this time to the point earlier that some people misunderstand the purpose of God. And I'll add here that this obsession with, and all this discussion devoted to this idea of the problem of evil, we mean it strictly in this physical, temporal realm in existence. But I would argue that much of the discussion stems from a basic and fundamental misunderstanding of the purpose of this life. And the argument reflects an unhealthy and an unwise and a completely unscriptural attachment to this body.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's the idea that God is to serve us instead of being to serve God.
And that this life serves itself in and of itself instead of a purpose that is to be attained in a life to come. It's focused on the here and now and not eternity. And it's a fundamental philosophical break. At the moment you enter this conversation with a person that's not thinking this way, the thing you should be aware of, and I think one of the takeaways tonight for when you have this discussion to get in the future, is that there is a basic fundamental break that's often not recognized at the outset of the discussion. And that much of the argumentation comes from a completely unscriptural understanding and attachment to this life. And it's a flawed value. It's a flawed valuation system.
this one is an extremely direct, on point, and explicit discussion of what we're talking about here. This does go to the necessary condition argument, a version of the necessary condition argument.
Isn't it fair to say that we talk about so much of our studies in the New Testament, but so much of Jesus' message was a huge warning against comfort in this life, against the attaining of pleasures, against the attaining of wealth. The very things that, if we start off with the original argument, which is, if I was God, I would never let there be suffering. In other words, comfort in the flesh. And yet Christ, even when he talks to the rich young ruler, when he talks about Lazarus and the wealthy, you realize very quickly that he's making a point. Ultimately, what you consider suffering, I consider growth. And what you consider comfort, I consider the most dangerous position that you could possibly be in. It once again brings us back to Job. How can you possibly understand the mind of a God? Basically, show our immaturity as children. Don't we say that to our own children? You have no idea what you're talking about. It is ironic that we turn around as adults and say to God, let me tell you what you should be thinking.
What else? Questions?
Original premise that they gave you.
Yes.
Omnipotent and benevolent. They only look at one side of that. And they take, and they don't, and if they get to an extreme, but they won't take every bit of it to the extreme. If you take his knowledge and, if you take it to the extreme that suffering could be eliminated, then you take that to the extreme, then death could be eliminated. We wouldn't be here. You would have two great big people on earth that consumed everything that did not replenish anything. Everything would be a consumption. It would go against the law of degeneration. So you can't take benevolence and by itself and say, well, God doesn't love us because he allows us to suffer. Well, if you're going to use that argument, then you take the other one to the extreme too. And that is an unsustainable world, and you wouldn't be here. Nobody would be here, because it would just be the first cell, it would just be the first thing created, or the first thing to crawl out of the slime, and we'd still be here.
If I can build on your point there about taking the one to the extreme, and that you meant the third one, the Latin word. So what was different about those three words, besides the first two being Greek and the third one Latin, is that what's implied in all that atheistic argument, though, is that they immediately switch to a different concept. And they switch to the concept, if you think about it, this is not correct, I'm going to make this word up, but they're really arguing an idea of, we say omniscient, omnipotent, and benevolent. We don't say omnibenevolent. But that's implied in their argument. They immediately make that switch. And I think that's what you meant by they take that to the extreme.
Right.
Right? So that's important to remember is that somebody was saying first, let's describe, what you mean by evil. Well, you should also, if somebody's going to make that argument to you, describe what you mean by benevolent. Again, I would argue that as the hand of God moves in the affairs of men, it often unfolds beyond the span of a single human's life, and so it's hard for us to perceive the why and the wherefore of it all. And again, I remind everybody of limited human knowledge in these things. I want to go back, though, to a point that was made right at the very beginning, and it's the really last point I have made. Is
Somebody pointed out that on this idea of benevolence, I do think that there is a sense in which it means exactly what everybody wants it to mean. That what God wants for people is exactly what God made for people. God made the Garden of Eden, where humans lived in full communion with God and did not know death. And in fact, God wants that so much that even when we were bound and determined to destroy that particular relationship in existence, God has occupied every moment of the rest of this world's history attempting to bring us back to that point for all eternity. Mm-hmm. And that's the story of the Bible. And in fact, the entire Bible is addressing this so-called problem of evil. There's a problem with evil, that sometimes we do evil things. That's a problem. And God in his benevolence has gone to extraordinary lengths to heal the breach and to reconcile us in spite of evil. Because if somebody, I can give credit to life. That was you. That's not how it was in the garden. And if you want to know what a benevolent God wants, you simply have to look at what a benevolent God made. And what a benevolent God made was the Eden experience. And what a benevolent God is moving us towards is a heaven experience. So, that's really all I had prepared. Look at that panel. That was awesome. Questions? So I really need your ideas if you have a special topic for the last three classes. We are going to circle back on the first eight lessons and talk about this idea of faith. And you need to review like the opening verses of Jude and refresh yourself on the finer thinking of subjective versus objective faith, and how we use the words a little more precisely and how they relate to the things we've discussed up to this point in the curriculum. But I'm really open to your ideas for those last two classes. They can be pretty much on anything, because we've covered anything that fits anywhere under the really broad topic of evidences. So if you want to go back over like canonicity or you want to... We've not done... much archaeology we've used as supporting points. It's not the reason for that is because I don't know anything about it. But if we want to go back into, the Thompson book that you have, the last half of it we haven't read, if you read through there, it does these like 1.5-page summaries of different fields of the physical sciences relating to God's revelation, things like that. If there's something in there that piques your interest, last week we talked about the argument from design. We mentioned but did not cover things like the anthropic principle and things like that. So any of that stuff is available to you, or something that we haven't touched on yet, I'm open to it. Thanks.